Shrink Wrap Radio number 361, Deep Blues with Jungian analyst Mark Winborn.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst Dr. Mark Winborn, and we'll be discussing my all-time favorite musical form, the blues, from an archetypal perspective. Mark Winborn, Ph.D., is a Jungian psychoanalyst and clinical psychologist. He's a training and supervising analyst of the Interregional Society of Jungian Analysts, and is also affiliated with the National Association for the Advancement of Psychoanalysis and the International Association for Analytical Psychology. He was recently nominated to the Accreditation Committee of the American Board for Accreditation in Psychoanalysis. In 2011, he published Deep Blues, Human Soundscapes for the Archetypal Journey, with Fisher King Press. His second book, Shared Realities, Participation, Mystique, and Beyond, will be published later in 2013. He lectures nationally and internationally. Dr. Winborn maintains a private practice in Memphis, Tennessee, where he is also currently the training coordinator for the Memphis Jungian Seminar. Apart from his analytic activities, he's also had a long-standing interest in music, playing blues for a year on Beale Street in Memphis with the Blue Blake Trio, and later playing bluegrass for 4 years with the Wolf River Travelers. He's also regularly engaged in physical activity, running, bicycling, weightlifting, and backpacking. Now here's the interview. Dr. Mark Winborn, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hey, Dave. It's great to be here. I appreciate you inviting me.
Yeah, well, I'm so pleased to meet a Jungian blues man. Two of my favorite things, Jungian psychology and the blues. So let's start out by having you take us on your journey to becoming a Jungian analyst. Starting way back, I believe you were an undergraduate at Michigan State University. What years would that have been? I'm just curious because I did my graduate work at the University of Michigan.
Well, I was a undergrad at Michigan State from 78 through 82.
Okay. We were not in Michigan at the same time, I can tell you. I'm older than you are.
Yeah.
Okay. And I believe that you were doing your undergraduate work on an ROTC scholarship. Do I have that right? Tell us a little bit about those years.
Yeah, that's right. I really wasn't clear what I wanted to do in undergraduate school at all, and I kind of stumbled into the ROTC program and really found it gave me a center that I needed at that time, and managed to go through undergraduate on an ROTC scholarship and go to airborne school and air assault school, and was really quite a gung-ho kind of guy at that point in time.
Doesn't sound like a Jungian at all.
No, a lot of people are kind of surprised by that background when they hear it. And, yeah, it doesn't fit with what we would expect of a Jungian analyst. But I see a thread there that kind of carries through in terms of that attraction to the warrior archetype that mm-hmm. was an important part of my development.
Now, you say you were the schools that you went to. Did you become a jumper, a parachutist?
Yes, a parachutist and infantry attack from helicopters, which means rappelling down on a rope out of helicopters from about 200 feet up.
Wow. Now, did you see combat at all?
No, I did not.
Okay.
This was the time I was on active duty were the years leading up to Desert Storm. And in fact, Desert Storm took off almost immediately after I separated from the Army.
Well, I would be inclined to say lucky you, although maybe you would have liked to live out that archetype more. I'm not sure.
Well, as I've continued to have contact with my friends from the ROTC days, I do experience a certain I don't know if regret's the right word, but a certain feeling that that was a road not traveled.
Yeah. Now, were you a psych major while you were an undergraduate, sort of thrashing around, wondering what you were going to become?
No, actually, I started out as a criminal justice major because that's what ROTC guys took to have more time to focus on their ROTC activities. But I found it kind of an empty major for me and kind of went into a real depression during midway through my junior year. And I started searching around. I knew I had to graduate in 4 years because that's the requirement of the ROTC scholarship. And I was really desperate to find something I could be interested in. And midway through my junior year, I looked through the entire college catalog, and psychology was the only thing I could transfer into and still graduate on time. And luckily enough, I took to it, really enjoyed it, and quickly realized I needed to go to graduate school, which the Army was kind enough to give me an educational delay for 4 years to pursue my PhD.
Oh, that's great. Did they fund you as well or just give you the delay?
They just gave me the delay, although yeah. I was on what's termed inactive reserve, so I did get continue to receive my time, what they call time in grade. So I was already a commissioned officer and earning points towards retirement or pay grades, things like that, while I was in graduate school.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like it worked out pretty well for you. Now, where did you do your graduate work to become a PhD psychologist?
I went through the clinical psych program at University of Memphis in Memphis, Tennessee.
And how did you end up there? Was there something in particular that drew you there, or is that where you grew up? What?
No, I grew up in Michigan.
Huh.
My father was a prof at at Michigan State University, and University of Memphis. Partially, it was their real focus on being a practitioner-oriented program at the time. And so I really wanted to get a lot of good practical experience from the program, and they had that available at the time.
And then at what point did you become a Jung? When did you get interested in Jung?
I actually got interested in Jung while I was doing my internship, my 1 year doctoral internship at William Beaumont Army Medical Center. So I went on active duty to do my internship. The Army has 4 internship sites around the country, and I picked William Beaumont in El Paso, and they had a very supportive, really warm, engaging program there. And their real interest was in helping you discover who you wanted to be as a psychologist. And they weren't really invested in pushing you in any particular direction. They just gave you as much exposure to as many different orientations as possible and encouraged you to delve deeper wherever you found your interest taking you.
This was the Army that you're talking about?
This was the Army.
That doesn't fit my stereotype.
No, it doesn't. But we had a really great director there named Tim Jeffrey, who unfortunately passed away in 1998. And he was just a very intelligent, warm guy and really had a heart for bringing young psychologists along and helping them develop an identity as a psychologist. And it was through some outside consultants that came in and that were interested in Jung and that I developed a relationship with. And once I finished internship, I was assigned to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, and I had all of the opportunity in the world to go into New York City and take classes at the Jung Institute there, another place called the Institute for Depth Psychology, run by a Jungian analyst named Don Kalshed, and find my first personal analyst at that time. So it was really another very supportive environment there. My clinical director was a psychoanalyst from the William Allison White Institute in New York, and he was very encouraging of me pursuing the Jungian path, even though he had pursued a different one himself. And so my experiences in the Army were just tremendous in terms of formulating my identity as both a psychologist and a Jungian analyst.
That's it. Really, it does so extraordinarily break stereotypes about the Army and about West Point. I mean, here you are teaching at West Point and in the process getting trained to be a Jungian. What was it about the Jungian perspective that particularly drew you in and spoke to you?
Well, I had had some pretty profound spiritual experiences while I was in graduate school. And seeking to reconcile what was happening to me spiritually with what I was studying from a psychological perspective, that did start the search for some way of finding a compatibility between these two worlds. And when I was on internship and started reading Jung, that was really what iced it for me. Was here was a guy who was not just speaking both languages, but integrating both languages of psychology and spirituality in a very deep way. And so I think that's what hooked me into the whole Jungian journey.
Can you tell us anything about the spiritual experiences that you had during that time?
Well, I had grown up exposed to the Methodist Church and just never had felt connected to it or its message. But when I came south for graduate school, there was a very different feel about the churches down here and the commitment and dedication. And I had what would be called a conversion experience in mm-hmm. which I had in the middle of the night one night this very oceanic feeling in which I clearly felt the presence of God and a diffusion of my own sense of self at the same time. And it literally shook me down to my foundations, and I think I would have considered myself an atheist, probably an agnostic at best, prior to that experience.
Wow.
And it was like a one-night conversion, and I spent time in a kind of fundamentalist outlook about spirituality for a period of time that was actually another important developmental piece for me, and I've since moved out of that way of looking at things, but the reality of the spiritual experience itself has always stayed with me.
Well, that's an extraordinary story. I'm glad that we got to hear a bit about that. Now let's backtrack and have you take us through your career as a blues man. At what point did you discover the blues?
Well, I really discovered the blues as a teenager. I was playing trombone in the middle school band, and somehow my parents found out about this student over at Michigan State, this music student named Eddie Struble, who's now a composer, arranger, musical director out in L.A. after a long stint in as musical director for the Kenny Rogers Band. And he was a young guy, had an afro, and played all sorts of instruments, trombone, harmonica, keyboards, rode a chopper. So I was very enthralled with this whole persona. And he had what in the music world you would call big ears. In other words, he listened to anything and everything. And he was always telling me, oh, you should get this record, or let me make you a copy of this record. And so he introduced me to all sorts of kinds of music, not just, the stuff I was learning to play on trombone, but blues, jazz, soul, all sorts of things. And it was out of that that I really got exposed to the blues and started liberating. My father had one Lightnin' Hopkins record in his collection, and I liberated that one and then bought B.B. King's Back in the Alley, and I can't remember all the initial ones, but this is about the time I'm 13 or 14 years old, and something about the blues really spoke to me at that time and has continued to speak to me.
Yeah, yeah. Lightnin' Hopkins, one of my all-time favorites, by the way.
Oh, yeah. He's just tremendous.
Yeah.
Baby, please don't go. Now, baby, please don't go. Now, baby, please don't go back to New Orleans. You know I love you so, baby, please.
Now, I believe you actually had a performing career for a number of years. Tell us about that and how it came about.
Well, it came about really out of the work. In the analytic training program, we had to write a number of papers around archetypal themes, usually myths, fairy tales, and religions. And after a while, I asked the guy who was the coordinator of our training program whether it'd be okay to write one on the blues rather than one of the typical topics. One of the analysts who read the paper said, "You know, there's really a lot of meat here. I think you ought to turn this into your analytic thesis," which we all have to write to graduate from the analytic training.
Hmm.
And so I wrote this thesis, and while I'm writing it, I really, this is in my late 30s, I'm realizing I don't want to just be a listener anymore. I want to be a participant in the blues, a performer. So I took up harmonica. And after about a year, got up the courage to go down to Beale Street in Memphis, Tennessee, which is one of the real pilgrimages that people make around the blues.
Yeah, I would say you worked up a lot of courage after only a year.
Well, I have a bit of stage fright, and going up on stage for the first time nearly undid me, but yeah. I managed to get through it and continued to play with a group of guys called the Blue Blake Trio. And for about a year on Beale Street at a little place called W.C. Handy's Blues Hall. And that was quite an experience. And after a while, having a wife and kids and my full-time private practice, the blues nightlife kind of wore me down, and I had to take a exodus from having a regular gig on Beale Street.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, you were you also a singer, and did you pick up other instruments, for example, the guitar?
At that time, I wasn't singing. I didn't have much confidence in my singing. That came a little bit later. I was just playing harmonica behind this guy, Blue Blake, who was the guitar player, and another guy named Mark Ross, who was a mandolin player. And so we played acoustic country blues primarily. And then after I got away from the Beale Street scene, I took up mandolin with this Mark Ross guy. And after about a year, formed a bluegrass band called the Wolf River Travelers. And we played together for 4 years, having, you know, regular gigs at different places. And that's when I started developing the singing. And so I was kind of the front person for that band and took a lot of the lead vocals for that band. And then after I got busy with some other things and couldn't maintain the band anymore, then I took up guitar. So I do a little bit of mandolin, harmonica, and guitar and continue to sing, but more on an informal basis and at open mic nights and things like that rather than having any regular gigs.
Well, I'm really jealous of your musical career, and it sounds like you've had a lot of fun with it. And what an interest, so many interesting strands in your life that one wouldn't necessarily expect. Which blues men or women were your primary influences? Who comes to mind as the main people that influenced you in relation to the blues?
Well, initially, it was a lot of this, the B.B. King kind of stuff, the real kind of uptown, sophisticated.
Chicago, right? Chicago blues?
Chicago blues. I still love the Chicago blues a lot. That's a very raw sound. Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, Sonny Boy Williamson, Little Walt, all of those cats from the Chicago blues scene. And, of course, most of them came from Memphis and West Arkansas, Eastern Arkansas, and Northern Mississippi. But the guys that really are influencing me now is a kind of a particular subset of the blues called North Mississippi Hill Country Blues. And there's three people that really typify that. One is R.L. Burnside. One is Junior Kimbrough. And the third is a woman named Jessie Mae Hempel.
These, I don't know any of them.
Well, they're not quite as well known as people like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf or B.B. King, but they play a really raw, kind of primitive droning style of blues that often just has one chord in the song, and they're just playing kind of the same hypnotic, repetitive riff over and over again.
I like that.
It's just wonderful to me.
Yeah, I've always had a kind of receptivity, and maybe it's just a basic human receptivity to that drone, what you call a drone, whether it's Tibetan chanting or the didgeridoo or certain blues styles, that there is something very archetypal, I guess, about that kind of a sound that takes you into an archetypal space.
And you can really hear that particular sound when you go into West African music. Mm-hmm. There's African singers called griots, G-R-I-O-T.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the tribal song archive. There's usually one or two particular people that store the tribe's stories in the form of these songs called griots. And when you listen to the recordings of them, they're playing these one string droning instruments and singing in a call and response pattern on top of it. And it's very similar to Mississippi Delta blues. Mm-hmm. In many ways. You can really hear the influence there. And that's what came over with the people that were enslaved and brought to the Americas, and what these griot songs became the work songs that these slaves were singing that they termed our hoolies.
And that's interesting because I encountered that in your book. And I thought, oh, Arhuli Records, that's where that name came from.
Because
a lot of folk music is recorded on that label, Arhuli.
Yes, that's exactly right.
City, hallelujah, get you drinking,
those songs turned into work songs in prisons and chain gangs. And eventually that's what became evolved into the blues.
It's amazing to think about the progression because African American music, African music, if we go all the way back to its roots, has had such an impact on the entire planet, on, you know, music coming out of this country and culturally infecting the rest of the planet is so heavily influenced by black music.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you think of Jimmy Rogers in country music, and you think of all of the British invasion bands like the Animals and Cream and bands like that, I'm blocking on their names, some of the other names of those. At any rate, all the Rolling Stones, those bands were all trying to sound like blues bands.
Yeah, yeah.
America kind of rediscovered their love affair with the blues when the British invasion bands brought it back over.
And do you see any kind of lineage for hip-hop and rap and some of the things that are going on now? Do they connect in some way to this blues tradition, griot tradition?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that rap and hip-hop are, if we hadn't had the blues, we wouldn't have rap and hip-hop. We wouldn't have soul. We would probably still have jazz, but jazz and blues have mutually influenced each other back and forth throughout the decades of their existence.
Now, you've written a lovely little book titled Deep Blues, and the subtitle is Human Soundscapes for the Archetypal Journey. What led to your taking up that project? And I'm wondering if it's an outgrowth of that thesis that you mentioned earlier.
Well, it was the thesis originally, and I graduated from my analytic training in 1999, and the thesis, you know, was accepted for my analytic requirements, and I pretty much let it sit on the shelf for 10 years and didn't do anything with it. I was busy with other projects like the Bluegrass Band and such, and eventually, a friend of mine who knew about it asked if this PhD student in ethnomusicology could read it. And his name is Bill Ellis. He's both a musician, an ethnomusicologist, and a music journalist. And he read it, and knowing his journalistic background, I respected his opinion, and he said, "I really think there's a lot here. You really need to try to publish this." So out of that little synchronistic event, I started taking it around to the different Jungian publishers, and Mel Matthews at Fisher King Press was very interested in it and picked it up, and Mel's a great guy and was very supportive of the whole process of turning the thesis into a book that was more readable to the lay public, and gave me a great deal of freedom once again in designing the cover, selecting the cover art, the photographs, things like that.
Yeah, the photographs are wonderful. I love them.
And that's another amazing, you know, Jungians are always looking for synchronicities. I really didn't have the budget to pay one of these photo services to license their photographs. And I happened to stumble on a website of this guy, Tom Smith, and his photographs were just so gritty and real and unposed that I approached him and I said, "I don't have much money to publish this thing, but, you know, if you'd be interested in having your photographs published, I'd love to do that." And he was amenable to that. The cover painting is a guy named Chopper Pescapia, and he had already sold the painting I wanted to use as the cover art, and he said, "Don't worry, I'll paint another one, and it will be better than that one that I sold." And sure enough, he did. And he deepened the colors and made it more intense, and I've got that picture hanging on my wall in my office.
Oh, yeah, it's a great picture. I'm going to encourage people to consider purchasing this book, and at the very least, they can go on to Amazon to get a look at the cover photo. Is there anything more that you'd like to say about the genesis of the blues? You mentioned the griots in Africa. You've got kind of, you say quite a bit in the book about the genesis mm-hmm. of the blues, and is there more that you'd like to add?
Well, I think that the real element that was in researching the genesis of the blues that it drove home for me was that all of these were efforts at transforming experience. You know, of taking these griot songs and adapting them to these incredibly harsh conditions of slavery and then the post-slavery era, to the unbearable conditions of places, these prisons like Parchman Farm and Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola, that this was a way that these individuals were taking just unbearable circumstances and somehow using music to transform that into some sort of bearable experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's really what I took away from the genesis of the blues, was the powerful transformative quality of music in general, but the blues specifically, because it's really the only genre of music that particularly crafted to both be a musical form, but to express a particular emotion. So it refers to both a musical form and it's literally a feeling, the blues. I have the blues.
Right. And I like the way that you universalize the blues in the first chapter of the book by linking it to Greek tragedy, so that there's a way in which the blues have always been with us.
Right. Yeah, it really is about the emotions that the Greeks were dealing with in their tragedies, of making tragic experience bearable.
A lot of people wonder, what is the blues? I hear a lot of people saying the blues, but I'm gonna tell you what the blues is. When you ain't got no money, you got the blues. When you ain't got no money to pay your house rent, you still got the blues. A lot of people holler about, I don't like no blues, but when you ain't got no money and can't pay your house rent and can't buy you no food, you damn sure got the blues. If you ain't got no money, you got the blues, because you're thinking evil. That's right. Anytime you're thinking evil, you're thinking about the blues.
You know, along those lines, there's another musical form that's always spoken to me very deeply in a similar way to the blues, and that's flamenco. And I've long thought that there's a way in which flamenco and the blues are very much the same, springing from the same source, but through two different cultural expressions. What do you think about that idea?
Oh, I think the blues element is definitely there in flamenco. It's also there in certain aspects of Appalachian music.
Mm-hmm.
It's there in Portuguese fado music.
Yes. Yeah, I only recently discovered that, but definitely I was actually in Europe And there's this, I guess, a rather famous young blonde fado singer. You might know her name. I'm blocking on it. And she was on a TV show that I was watching. I can't even remember what country I was in. But I was totally mesmerized. I had never heard fado before.
I hadn't either until a few years ago. But, yeah, once you hear it, you can definitely hear the similarities. And in Mali, there's a guy that Ry Cooder has recorded with that's relatively well known now, but Ali Farka Tour, who you can really hear this blues. I don't know if it's an influence particularly, but the similarities of this music he's playing and other guitarists from that area, it's very bluesy sounding.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the subtitle of your book, which again is Human Soundscapes for the Archetypal Journey. So what is the archetypal journey? Would it be something like Joseph Campbell's Journey of the Hero, or do you have something else in mind?
Well, that's the hero's journey is one pattern that people may be living out. But I think we're all living out some sort of archetypal journey, depending on which archetypes we're connected to, you know, and sometimes that shifts during a point in our lives. People who go into therapy as a profession are often connected to this healer archetype. Sometimes the wise old man, or you could say the shaman, is a particular manifestation of the healer archetype. But I think we're all on an archetypal journey, and almost, I don't think anybody gets through this life without a degree of pain, grief, sadness, loneliness, despair. And so I think that the what I'm calling the archetypal journey in reference to the blues is that this is part of the journey that we're all sharing together. And the blues has a tremendous amount to say to us about that.
You know, I'm hearing a little bit of a sort of scratching noise in the background, and I'm wondering if you might be nervously playing with the cord or something.
No, I think I'm just being a little bit too animated and moving my head too much.
Oh, really? Okay.
I'll try to be a little bit less excited.
Okay, I'm glad that we've got you being animated here. Now, at several points in the book, you take up the question of defining the blues, and you quote various authors and bluesmen. What's your own personal definition of the blues?
Well, my personal definition is, of the blues would probably be more around the agenda of the blues. And the blues singer and blues musician is connecting with something about their own experience as they're singing the song. And the idea is that they want to communicate that way, that feeling in a way that it connects to something in the listener and therefore joins the performer to the listener. So for me, the blues is about connecting between performer and audience, between the performer and his own experience. So that there's an experience of connection that can't be denied.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Make Me a Parrot on the Floor. Lay me down, pat it on your floor. Make me down. Make me a pallet down, soft and low. Make me a pallet on your floor. country by the cold, sleeting snow. They're going up the country by the cold, sleeting snow. I'm going up the country by the cold, sleeting snow. No telling how much further I may go. Just make me down. Make me down. Make me a pallet down soft and low. Make me a pallet on your floor.
I'd like to give you a little bit of a background of why I'm so interested in this topic, and also to for my listeners, because they might be, they're kind of used to me going off in all sorts of unexpected tangents. But just to make it a little clearer about what got me so excited about your book and your work, your perspective, is I was raised in a multiracial home, having a black stepfather from infancy. And as a result, I grew up with lots of black music, in old records, you know, 78 records. They had my parents had this huge record cabinet, and I would get in there and do these explorations, you know, and discover all this wonderful music. So they weren't country blues singers that I later came to fall in love with, but they were performers like Billie Holiday, the Ink Spots, Nat King Cole, Sarah Vaughan, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, as well as rhythm and blues on the radio dial that I was hearing. And then in college, I got caught up in the folk boom. I was in college in the mid-60s, and so was really grabbed by country blues, and the blues performers I was most affected by in those days were the likes of Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry, Lightning Hopkins, who we mentioned, Big Bill Brunsey, John Lee Hooker, Blind Reverend Gary Davis, Mississippi John Hurt, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I did it. And I tried to become a blues man, I guess, but my technical skills, I didn't have enough musical background or teachers really to pick it up to the degree that my soul was responding to it and yearning to express it. And in fact, we were talking about the drone earlier, and as an undergraduate, I remember sitting around in a dorm room with my friends, and we had been drinking Purple Jesus, was what we called it. Don't want to offend anyone. That was a mixture of red wine and vodka, and all I knew to do on the guitar at that point was I could play the E chord and the A chord. And just rocking back and forth between the E chord and the A chord, and we would have this sort of blues-type drone music and make up words. And we would just go around making up our own blues words. And as I think back about it, that was a very precious and formative experience. And a lot of it, I think, was the coming out of the angst and fear of being students.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a certain amount of angst and oppression that can come about in education.
Well, and that speaks exactly to what I was just saying, that feeling of recognizing that there's a shared experience everyone is having, and then the desire to go beyond that shared experience and express it in some deeper way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely what was going on for us.
That deepens that connection.
Yeah. Now, you have a chapter titled Archetypal Manifestations in the Blues. What are some of these archetypal manifestations that you're referring to?
Well, I think a lot of the characters that appear in blues songs, I would say, have an archetypal basis. You know, the idea of the trickster, for example.
That's just what came to mind. Go ahead.
And it is a common theme in mythology. Loki from Norse mythology, for example, and Hermes from Greek mythology, they're trickster gods who you can't really tell where they're going to settle down and whose side they're going to settle down on and how long they're going to stay on a particular side. And so they're always playing tricks with us. And a lot of the characters in blues songs are kind of tricksterish. You know, they may be singing about one experience, and then suddenly it sounds like they're singing about the opposite experience, and it kind of can be a head jolt a little bit. But then you realize that in the blues, there's not such a distinction made between opposites. And so T-Bone Walker's Stormy Monday, where he talks about getting paid on Friday, and then Saturday he's going to go out and play, and then Sunday morning he's still going to go to church and get down and pray. And so these distinctions that we often fall into aren't quite as rigidly held in the blues world. Somebody can be sacred and profane at the same time in the blues world, and that's that tricksterish element. So, and there's the bad guy. They're
right. I'm thinking
love.
Guys who made a deal with the devil, you know?
Yeah, that's Robert Johnson's story.
Right.
I went to the crossroads, fell down on my knees.
Brings in the shamanistic. It's very much like a shamanistic initiation. Robert Johnson goes down to the crossroads at Highway 61 in Mississippi and sells his soul to the devil for guitar mastery. And the story is that he was a pretty mediocre guitarist as a young man, kind of got embarrassed, went off on his own, and a number of months later resurfaces with a dramatically improved style. And the story was told that that's what happened, as he sold his soul to the devil. And there's a number of other stories in addition to his that aren't as well known and often have some details, like you have to clip your fingernails and give the clippings to Satan when you exchange the guitar, when he gives the guitar back to you.
Mm-hmm.
As though the clippings of your nails contain a degree of your life force that Satan now then possesses.
I'd be sorely tempted if Satan appeared to me and offered to make me an incredible blues guitarist.
Well, I think we see some elements of that same theme in performers of various types who get very addicted to substances. And I think on some unconscious level, it's almost like there's a deal being made of, I'm going to exchange this part of myself in the hopes of attaining some deeper mastery of my craft.
That's an interesting idea. Yeah. Yeah. That whole getting involved with drugs and the nightlife and in search of some deeper intensity.
Right. Right.
me for another man.
You talk about the blues as connecting people to what you refer to as unitary reality, and that part gets pretty heavy theoretically. What are you getting at there?
Well, it starts out with Carl Jung. He borrowed an idea from an anthropologist named Levi Brühl that was called participation mystique. And this is the notion that there's a blurring between a blurring that can occur between one person and another person, where the boundaries get a little diffuse and you don't know quite where they end and you begin. And that's, we can see that easily in a blues performance. As soon as the first drum beat sounds and everybody locks into tapping their feet, nobody said tap your feet, but everybody locks into that downbeat of the drum.
Wow. Yes.
Well, they're sharing something. Everybody's in link. Or you should go to a football stadium and everybody's wearing the same color shirt and screaming the same things. They're in a participation mystique in which the thing that they're participating in has become more important than their individual psyche. And unfortunately, this whole notion of participation mystique got kind of pejoratively perceived, that that was a bad thing to do, that people with a strong conscious element shouldn't be slipping into these participation mystique states. And this guy, Eric Neumann, came along and said, I don't think it's all bad. I think there's a great deal of good also that comes from these participation mystique states. And I'm going to take a term called unitary reality to kind of reframe it and say that there's a field that gets constellated between people, and that there's positive elements, sense of connection, new awarenesses that come from that. And we're seeing a lot of this come out now in the neurosciences with mirror neurons, in where we now know some of the mechanisms behind this participation mystique, and that it's very important for our sense of connection to other people. And we see it coming out in quantum physics, what they call quantum realities, which is based on the idea that everything is interconnected. And so the technical theoretical developments that have emerged since Jung and Neumann are very confirmatory of these kind of states.
You know, I'm thinking now about gospel music and spirituals, and part of my growing up involved going to an African Methodist Episcopal Church, AME Church, that had an incredible choir, incredible preaching, and we now see that depicted in a number of movies have brought that element in, where you see the congregation as just they're in that unitary consciousness with a call and response that you talked about, where the preacher is laying it out line by line, and he's getting amens and hallelujahs back, and there is that reciprocal energy that's being exchanged, and it's mounting and mounting and mounting.
You could even make the argument that the preacher, the choir, and the congregation become one instrument.
Yes.
That they're absolutely in sync, but it's also a dialogue that's going on. And that's an important part of the improvisational nature of both jazz and blues between performers, is that there's a dialogue going on musically where they're playing off of each other.
Yeah.
And that they're taking each other to places they didn't know existed.
I hope you like it. Sitting by my window, whoa, I was looking out at the rain.
Right. And I'm sure as a musician, you've had that, even as a minor musician myself, as a semi-musician, I've had experiences like that. And I'm sure you must have had many.
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes when we would have one of our regular band members in this Wolf River Travelers band unable to perform with us, and we might get somebody to sit in for them who was playing at a higher level, and the whole band would go up to this other person's level.
Yeah.
It was astonishing that we would find capabilities that we didn't even know we had.
Yes.
When somebody else sat in with us.
Yes, yes. I've had that experience with certain individuals who have a generosity. There are musicians who are not generous and who just like to show off their expertise. There are others, rare ones that I've encountered, who have such a generosity of spirit that they would kind of stoop down to somebody of my level and figure out a way to bring me in to kind of weave stuff around whatever I could do. And then, as you say, kind of pull me up to a higher level where I was transcending anything that I had ever done before. And the inner emotional experience of that was ecstatic.
Absolutely. It's amazing when that kind of generosity happens.
You know, you also talk about healing in relation to the blues, and that's maybe something we should touch on, too.
Well, I think that in terms of Jungian terms, Jungians often talk about connecting to and incorporating one's shadow. And the shadow is thought of as the parts of ourselves that are disowned, that we find objectionable from an ego standpoint, as well as the things in ourselves that haven't had an opportunity to develop. And that wholeness, which is a big part of healing in the Jungian framework of working, is about pulling those disowned and undeveloped elements of ourselves into connection. And I think the blues music, emphasizing the things that it does, which are emotions that in typical day-to-day life, most people try to avoid. They're trying to get out of depression. They're trying to avoid grief. They're trying to get away from a sense of loneliness.
Mm.
And blues puts us in touch with those, what I would term shadow emotions. And that's what I think is the healing capacity of the blues, is it pulls us into connection with elements that we would ordinarily be trying to avoid.
Fascinating. Yeah, that certainly rings true as I hear you describe it that way. I have to say it was brave of you to write about something that is such a visceral experience as the blues, and to try to, you know, weave some words around that in prose.
Well, it's not easy, and some of the colleagues that I who are also musicians that I shared it with, weren't sure it could be done. But since publishing the book, I've had some really wonderful confirmatory experiences from blues musicians who've read the book and come up to me or emailed me and said, you know, you really nailed it in ways that I would have never thought of describing, but mm-hmm. it makes absolute perfect sense to me.
Even non-Jungians?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely non-Jungians. I had some guy from Spain just 2 days ago, a guy named Danny Boy Sanchez, who's a blues harp player in Spain, and Valencia, Spain. And I have no idea about whether he has any interest in Jung at all, but he was very interested in this book, Deep Blues, and took the time to email me and talk about his experiences in reading the book. So I think it does manage to do what I hoped it would do, would be to articulate some things about the blues that make a lot of sense to people once they read them, but perhaps they wouldn't have thought about it that way on their own.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's got to be very gratifying for you to get that kind of feedback.
Absolutely. As a musician and as a analyst and writer, it's wonderful to get that kind of feedback.
Yeah.
Walk on, walk on, walk on, walk on, yeah, walk on, walk on, walk on, walk on. I'm gonna keep on walking till I find my way back home.
Woo!
Well, my mind gets worried when my shoes get thin. I don't know where I'm going, but I do know where I've been. I'm gonna walk on, walk on, walk on, gonna walk on. I'm gonna keep on walking till I find my way back home. That is, if you know, I'd rather be walking. I don't appreciate no rock, cause the woman I love, she's not here by my side. I'm gonna walk on. Walk on, walk on, I'm gonna walk on. I'm gonna keep on walking till I find my way back.
Woo!
Walk on one time, boy. Walk on.
Now, to shift the frame a bit here, I'm not sure if I recall this correctly or not, but I seem to recall that our first virtual meeting online was a response that you had posted on the Depth Psychology Alliance. Does that ring a bell?
It could be.
I think it was a commentary on one of my interviews.
Right.
And now you're in my sights.
Right.
And at the time it was to the effect that in one of my shrink wrap radio episodes, I had given the impression that Jungian psychology is a unitary monolithic thing, when in fact there are different schools of thought within the Jungian movement. So this is your chance to set the record straight and take us through that, if you will. When you think about Jungian psychology, what do you see as the major divisions or schools of thought?
Well, there's really three principal schools of thought, and I'm not the one who articulated this first. It was actually a guy named Andrew Samuels from England in a book called Jung and the Post-Jungians. But it is pretty accurate. The idea is that Jung had this focus on what he termed the self, which is the deeper pattern that formulates our life within us, and that emerges in a variety of symbolic ways that there's paralleled in mythology, fairy tales, religious motifs, things like that. And there's a number of people who continue to practice very much like Jung practiced psychotherapy, and schools that teach in that way. And those are referred to as the classical schools. Marie-Louise von Franz, who I think Monica Wickman has mentioned on your show, was certainly one of the practitioners who mm-hmm. carried on that tradition. And continues, she's deceased now, but people continue to teach in that fashion. There's also a school that developed in the early 1960s in London that is referred to as the London or Developmental School that developed around a gentleman named Michael Fordham. And he incorporated a lot of psychoanalytic technique and some psychoanalytic ideas, particularly from a woman named Melanie Klein, into the Jungian project. Mm-hmm. And that school of thought utilizes a lot more emphasis on the countertransference and transference relationship, working through the unconscious material in that particular manifestation, and a little bit less emphasis on the dream work, which is really the center of classical Jungian analysis. And then also emerging about the same time was a guy named James Hillman, who just died last year.
Right.
And he said there is no central organizing self, that the psyche is what he termed polytheistic, meaning many centers, having many centers rather than a monolithic center that Jung had called the self.
Okay.
He felt that the polytheistic psyche expressed itself most prominently through image. Now, dreams all contain images, but his interest was really in understanding what the image is trying to tell us, what the image is communicating to us, rather than trying to translate the dream into some other psychological language. And that became known as the archetypal school, or sometimes people just refer to it as the Hillmanian school.
Right.
So those three, the classical, the developmental, and the archetypal, are the three main schools of thought that Jungian analysts practice within.
Well, thank you for taking us through that. Now, are you yourself identified with one or the other of those?
Actually, I am. I'm much more identified with the developmental school or the London School, which incorporates a lot of psychoanalytic material into the process, while staying true to Jung's idea about the mythopoetic basis of the psyche, that psyche is going to manifest in terms of narratives, and around the idea of complexes being a central way of thinking about how the psyche is organized. And I came to that through an analyst named Mel Marshak, who died a couple of years ago, and she was a wonderful woman who had spent about 40 years in London and had trained at that institute that teaches this. And she was a big influence in my training here in the United States after she immigrated back.
Okay. Well, this might be a good place to wrap it up. Is there any final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I've got a little thing that I end my public presentations with, and I'll just read the last paragraph of that. It's very short. And I summarize it by saying, in this regard, the blues man or blues woman, by communicating feelings in song that resonate within the listener, serves as a modern day shaman who heals through the ritual of music. The blues originated in experiences of trauma, oppression, and enslavement, but now serve to liberate our emotional lives and facilitate a deeper union with our environment and those around us. Robert Johnson, Muddy Waters, and Howlin' Wolf all have something significant to contribute to the care of our souls.
Great. Well, Dr. Mark Winburn, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, Dr. Dave. It's been great. You're a great interviewer, and I've had a lot of fun doing it.
Walk on, walk on, walk on, walk on, yeah, walk on,
walk on. I got those low-down Jungian blues. Yes, I got those low-down Jungian blues. You know my anima and my animus. Their feet don't fit in the same pair of shoes. With apologies to my guest and blues men everywhere, I'm just feeling playful after that interview. Well, you heard me describe my background a bit, so perhaps you can understand my enthusiasm for the blues. And if you've listened to Shrink Wrap Radio for any length of time, you already know about my enthusiasm for the work of Carl Jung. So you can also understand my excitement about discovering Dr. Mark Winborn and his Jungian understanding of the blues. In case you're wondering who those performers were, you heard Nina Simone, Mississippi John Hurt, Blind Gary Davis, John Lee Hooker, Howlin' Wolf, Robert Johnson, Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry, Lightning Hopkins, B.B. King, and Big Mama Thornton, but not in that order. I got the bright idea of asking Mark to perhaps sing some blues songs on the show, but he demurred and instead suggested that he could grab some audio clips for me off of YouTube, which he did. However, it then occurred to me that I could grab some clips off of YouTube myself that would be more reflective of my own taste. So I'm hoping that you found the clips added something to our interview rather than just being an interruption. And if it's not clear to you, I should point out that I inserted the clips in more or less random places after the interview was over. If I wanted to spend a lot more time than I already spent, which was considerable, pulling this all together, then I would have placed them more strategically, making sure that the clip illuminated the very thing that we were talking about at that moment. And actually, I did do that with two or three of them. As always, I hope you will use the Amazon.com widget in the right-hand sidebar if you decide to buy this book. The title, once again, is Deep Blues. It's a thin volume, around 110 pages, and also quite affordable. Also, I should mention that there are lots of blues lyrics interspersed throughout the text, as well as a discography at the end of the book, which would be useful in building your own blues music collection. I thought you might appreciate a week off from donation requests, so enough said. So let me proceed directly to letting you know that we have a new free transcript on the site, thanks to listener Mariana Vault. She's transcribed number 354, What Aging Men Want, with John C. Robinson, Ph.D. Thanks for your help, Mariana. By the way, you'll find a link to Dr. Robinson's book, What Aging Men Want, in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. That book, along with others advertised there, will take you directly to the order page on Amazon or the author's site. And if you purchase them there, we get a small percentage to help support the podcast. For some reason, our listenership seems to go down in the summer, so I hope you'll remember to help promote the show by letting all your psychologically minded friends, colleagues, classmates, colleagues, and professors, and so on, about Shrink Wrap Radio, which personally I think has content that should appeal to pretty much everyone.
Hi, this is naturopathic Dr. Jonathan Prowski, and you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Jonathan Prowski, who I'm happy to announce will be my guest on our next episode. And more about that in a bit. But first, let's take a quick dip into the old email bag. And first, we hear from listener and frequent transcriber Gloria Ullman, who writes, David, what a coup to get Gabor Mate, and how great that you managed to get him before he went on his sabbatical. It says a lot for your reputation that he agreed to come on your show. I was surprised to hear at the end that you felt a bit intimidated by his experience and erudition. It didn't show at all, and your questions were pertinent and insightful. If you had a rating system, I would give this interview maximum stars. Hey, thank you. What an extraordinary gift to humanity this man is, not only for his work with others, but for his role modeling of the process of transformation at work within himself. His work and personal example is reminiscent of Stan and Christina Grof. That he has such a genuine and authentically positive approach in spite of being immersed in the very difficult arena of hardcore addictions is testament to the efficacy of his own healing work. I love the story he told of Cynthia's healing And his comment that there is always the possibility of transformation, no matter what you suffered, given the right support. What has long intrigued me is what it is that turns a person towards the path of transformation or keeps someone walking the path towards self-destruction. Somehow, I think the answer lies in the kinds of experience he described as that embarked by the ayahuasca, the experience of knowing at a deep level that love is our true reality. As he said, when you know that at a deep level, you don't need to seek for it on the outside in any form. Are the hungry ghosts simply the ignorance of our true nature and the fear that it might be other than love? Your interview with David Shane, where he talks about the archetypal shadow / archetypal evil and its antidote, archetypal good is worth listening to in addition to this one. Generational trauma goes back a long, long way, and even those who haven't suffered significant trauma in their own or their family's lives can't escape the effects of it because it is embedded in the collective unconscious. As Gaber pointed out, addictions can be very subtle, and we can be easily deluded by them. We all need to do the healing and transformational work, and it's hard work at times, but so rewarding. Thankfully, we have an extraordinary range of support in this day and age, and this podcast is one of them. And that was posted by Gloria in the comments area, actually. And what an erudite comment it is. And so, Gloria, I thank you for that comment, as well as for all the work that you've done on transcription for us. And because we are running long, once again, I'll include just one more short one from Dan, who writes, Dr. Dave, thanks for your email. I finished your episode regarding a dangerous method. Learned a lot from various perspectives. Now I'm making my way through the recent and very endearing episode with Dr. Mate. I really appreciate this program. I am currently a clinical social worker in the addiction field, and I'm also hoping to begin medical school next fall. I see you did your studies at the University of Michigan. That's where I did my graduate studies. Go Blue. And that's signed Dan. Well, Dan, I'm really impressed that you're going on to medical school after having become a clinical social worker. So good for you, and I wish you lots of strength on that journey. You'll probably need it. And Dan thanked me initially for my email, and my email was replying to an earlier one of his in which he alerted me to the fact that among the most recent 75 episodes, number 305 was one, and I don't remember the number of the other, there were two episodes that were only 1 second long as listed in iTunes. Well, I was able to correct that after some time. So if you happen to run into that problem, you should know that it has been fixed. So I appreciate Dan alerting me to that. And if you find problems that need to be fixed, do let me know. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, as you heard Gloria did. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to Jungian analyst Mark Winborn for turning us on to the archetypal dimensions of the blues. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with naturopath and author Dr. Jonathan Prowski, who will be speaking with us very authoritatively on nutrition as it relates to mental health. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Taking away all your blues.